accession number 9434, reel 19.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 19. You mentioned you wrote some pieces for newspapers during the First World War. I wonder if you could go into the background of that, of how you got into that line, and then questions of censorship and such like.
Well, actually, I wrote the Miss Bowater, the Lord Mayor's daughter, Sir Thomas Bowater's daughter, was very kind to me during the war. She sent me out Ovaltine tablets and little comforts things all through the war. And,
how had you known them?
I worked for them, you see.
As a gardener?
I'd worked as a gardener, you see. And she sent them out during the war. It was most kind. And in one letter I described the conditions in the Sanctuary Wood trenches in January 1915, you know, where they started using very lights at night, turning the night into day, you see. I described that, and to my what she did was she sent it on to the People newspaper, who published it in one of their columns, you see, published the letter. And that was the first start of my newspaper writing. And then later in the year, I wrote a fiction story called Hic Jacet, Here Lies, in Latin for Here Lies, and on the theme of a verse in Omar Khayyam's poem: I sometimes think that never blows so red the rose as where some buried Caesar bled. And I wrote the story on that, basing it on the profusion of flowers that sometimes grew over an unmarked grave on the battlefield, you know. And so that was published in The Graphic. It's quite a longish story, and in it I mentioned the council of the man who died had struggled for peace in the world, and that possibly that would be achieved in the future by the Council of the Nations. Now, I think that antedated the League of Nations by quite a considerable bit, but I'd got the idea forming in my mind all the time that something would happen in the future to stop the waste of the First World War. Those were two.
When you've submitted these, would they be put up for censorship by your officers?
Oh yes, they would be up for censorship, and they passed through. It passed through because it was fiction, you see.
And you as a serving soldier, you were allowed to do this sort of thing?
Oh yes, it was fiction.
Were there any others you had printed?
No, there may have been, but I couldn't recall them at the moment, but those were the two that I remember best.
Now, you worked for The Graphic, as you said, until the Second World War broke out.
No, I worked for The Graphic for 3 years, and then I went on to a paper called The Sunday Referee, which I stayed with until 1933.
Presumably your role had changed from being clerical. What?
Oh, yes, I was a manager. I was a manager of the department, you see. I became an advertisement manager. And then 1933, the owner of the paper got a contract with the Radio Luxembourg station, and I was given the job of managing that, you see, doing the business management of it. And which meant responsibility for getting all the sponsors to find the money for the programmes, you see. And we kept that for 3 years, and then we lost it in the courts, a famous court case, a case of broken they broke their contract with us, and the Americans stepped in and got it. But then I went back to the paper again, the Sunday Referee, and I continued with that until just in 1939, about 3 months before the war, the paper was sold and amalgamated with the Sunday Chronicle in Basin Road. And I was there. When the war broke out, I was there. And the Home Guard Company was formed, and I became a lieutenant in it.
How did you become a lieutenant? Was that...
Well, it was an appointment by the... by the major in charge of the company, who was the editor of the Sunday Chronicle, and because of my First World War experience, you see, I was trained with the rifle. I was fully trained with the rifle and bayonet, but my main duties were on the roof at night in the bombing, with my finger on the button to stop work down below or press it to let it go on, you see. I had to judge when it was safe for them to carry on working down below and when it wasn't safe. If I pressed the button, they all stopped work and took cover. That was our home guard duty, you see. Yeah. Mind you, we had some exercises, and we took up a position on Blackfriars Bridge, on the crest of the bridge, which was going to be one of our defensive positions. But I didn't stay with them very long, because in 1942, I went back to Goulburn British Picture Corporation, relinquished my home guard service, and started running a company called GB Screen Services, which made films for the war effort, you know, training films for the army, films for national savings and things like that.
What was your role in producing these films?
Well, my role was a managerial one, looking after the finance and making sure that everyone was not overdoing spending the mark, you see, because films can become expensive. I managed to get a good editor out of the Royal Air Force. We needed one. We were short of personnel. That was the sort of thing. And then when we were approached by people to make films, if I had an idea, I was creative, you see, as well. I used to write down, sketch a thing out on about one page, which told the story, and hand it to the scriptwriter to fill in the script, you see. And one such picture I wrote out was called Sam Pepys Joins the Navy. It was a picture. You see, we had a commission to make a film for national savings using the Navy. Now, how do you use the Navy for national savings? And the scriptwriter became stumped. And so I sat down, put my thinking cap on, and I remembered reading Pepys' diary that he was the founder of the British Navy. And he was always in trouble about money to keep the Navy going, you see. And so I sat down and I looked in the telephone directory, and I found there was a whole column of Pepys. People called his name was Pepys. And so there was my justification for a young man of 1942 whose name was Samuel Pepys. And so the film opened with him going up to join the Navy as a young entry, join it, going through his training with the officer looking up and, you know, saying, "Pepys, and I suppose your name is Samuel," and he nodded, "Yes." You see, and then going through his training at Chatham, and then eventually going to Whitehall for commission. And up on apparently the Navy office at Whitehall, there's a large portrait, an oil painting of Samuel Pepys, the founder of the Navy. And the camera turns to this portrait, and Pepys is brought down out of the picture by trick photography to a conversation with a modern naval officer on the cost of battleships, warships, and all that sort of thing, the huge costs. And Pepys ends up, he's visibly shaken, because in his book he says, "I asked the king for money for the Navy, and he said, would £50 be any use?" You see? So he said, "I told him that wouldn't even pay the rum merchant." But so that was the motive for Samuel Pepys, the one out of the picture, being visibly shaken when he was told the millions that modern warships cost, you see. And then the film ends by him saying, "Where do you get all this money from to buy make these ships?" And we went over to the post office counter where the civilian is buying war savings, you see. And that's the lesson of the film. Buy war savings and help the Navy. That was one which I scripted. And I was very proud of, because I spoke to the Ministry of Information officer afterwards and said, "How many cinemas have played that film?" He says, you'll be pleased to know that you hold the record for any film in England for single film. I said, well, you must be joking. He said, 3,200 cinemas have shown that film. And I was shaken. That little film, which only we made for about £3,500 and played for 3,200 cinemas, all for the National Savings Movement. That was the sort of activity I was in, you see.
Now, you were a commercial organisation.
Yeah.
How was your relationship between you and the Ministry of Information? How was it sorted out? How did they decide how much you'd be paid and how much profit you'd make and that sort of thing?
Well, we made an estimate to the Ministry of Information of what the cost would be, and it had to be a tight. It was so closely controlled that we lost money on nearly every film we made, and we had to go back begging for extra money to straighten our books. That was how tight the control was on that business in the Second World War. In the First World War, we would have made fortunes, but in the Second World War, no. The ministry control was so tight, as I say, we lost money on every film we made.
So there was
we had to go back and ask, beg for an extra grant to keep the book straight.
So was this the only business you did, or would this be a very bad time for your business then?
Oh, that was practically the only business we did. The only film I made, a commercial film in that time, which I needed to keep the company going, was a film called Golden Harvest. And a very, very peculiar story there. The head, Brown and Paulson, the cornflour people, the man who discovered cornflour was a man called John Paulson, Scotsman. And Brown and Paulson were controlled by Corn Products of Philadelphia, America, you see. And Brown and Paulson's centenary happened in 1942. And I was talking to their publicity man, and I said, you should have a film made. We ought to make a film to celebrate it, you see, and show it in the cinemas. Make a good film. Only five minutes long, just to celebrate the centenary. And so I sat, the scriptwriter again didn't seem to have much inspiration, so I sat down and wrote and said, drew up a short history, a history of maize. You know, cornflour is made from maize. And I drew up, the discovery of maize in America, the Pilgrim Fathers being given maize by the Indians, keep them alive, and so on, and the growth, and the great modern industry, and it's one of the staple products of America. I drew it up in the rough, turned it over to the scriptwriter, and said, well, this is interesting, isn't it? So he spent 2 days in the British Museum doing a real fine job of work on the history of maize, and that was the script of the film. Now, when it was called Golden Harvest, it was a lovely picture, in Technicolor, and it was the last Technicolor picture we made during the war. And in order to make it, the Royal Air Force had a monopoly of Technicolor during the war. But every reel of at the end of every reel they shot in the aeroplanes, there was about 100 feet perhaps left, because it goes through the camera 90 feet a minute. You know, film goes through 90 feet a minute. There was usually about a minute's film left. And so I got Technicolor to agree to join all these loose ends together to make enough film for us to make this commercial film, you see. And that's how we made it. And I knew if we made a success, it would be a feather in our cap. So the director of it, Francis Searle, did a smashing job. And then one day I remembered Hiawatha. In Hiawatha, Longfellow mentions corn, you see. So I grabbed a copy of Hiawatha, and I wrote out the passage, and I took the scriptwriter. I said, this will open the film. And the maize field grew and ripened till it stood in all the splendour of its garments, green and yellow, and its tassels and its plumage. And the maize ears, full and shining, gleamed with bursting sheaths of verdure. That was the opening of the film. A marvellous opening, free from greatest and for nothing, from Longfellow's Hiawatha. And the briefing I had for the commentator was, he mustn't be American, he mustn't be English, he mustn't be Scots, Irish, or any Australian or Canadian. He's got to have an absolutely international voice. And so, by the greatest of good luck, We had a marvellous actor in Gaumont making pictures called Finlay Curry, a Scotsman. And his voice was the most perfect voice ever. It wasn't Scots, it wasn't Irish, it wasn't Welsh, it wasn't English, it wasn't American. And he was the man who spoke that lovely opening verse. And I was thrilled to bits when I first saw it on the screen. The film was directed by Francis Searle, and the cameraman was the famous Technicolor cameraman Jack Cardiff. It was a lovely little film, 5.5 minutes, and made our reputation overnight. A man rang me up and said, I was going to get you to make a film for us on our commercial product. He says, I'm not going to have it made now. He says, you couldn't make one as good as Golden Harvest. That was how good it was, you see.
So that was what made the profits
That enabled us to make the government's films and lose money on them.
Were there any other government films you remember besides the savings one?
Well, yes, WAF. We made one called WAF, which was a recruitment film for the Women's Air Force. A very fine film. And, you know, in that film, it showed a briefing of a briefing of an RAF crew going out to bomb Germany. And in that film, for the first time, I heard, "This is your target for tonight." Now, who wrote that? A scriptwriter, I don't know. But that was probably an RAF man. But that was the first time I ever heard that film. And that became a byword for the rest of the war. "This is your target for tonight," in the RAF. So that air woman. And
what year was these films?
This would be 1942.
What about other ones? Can you remember any other ones?
We made one called... that was called Air Woman, the Air Woman film. We made artillery and an anti-tank role for D-Day, you see? And a transport film for D-Day. That's the sort of thing we were on, you see? Making films, instructional films, for the forces. The one for D-Day, the landing, was called Landing Craft. Landing Craft was instructional, carried out... you know, at sea and close to the coast, to instruct the troops who were going to go in more into Normandy on D-Day. And the Tullian and anti-craft role was done at a proper camp to teach gunners, you see. So that was the sort of thing we were doing. It was all war work.
How many people were employed by your company, and what were their roles?
Oh, not many. We had a director, Francis Searle. We had a cameraman, James Harvey, brother of Lillian Harvey, the film actress. A production manager, Eric Dane, I'm sorry he's dead now, and a script writer, Harold Goodwin, and about three more. That was all. There were only about seven, that's all.
So when you get the contract from the Ministry of Information.
We got the contract from Information, and then a script would be submitted, approved, and the film made.
And what exactly was your role?
My job was financial, watching the costs, and as I say, when necessary, adding a bit of creative effort as well, making suggestions.
How long would it take to make a film?
Oh well, it would depend on the weather. That's the trouble. You see, when artillery and an anti-tank role cost us a fortune because. They were sitting on location. They were sitting in there for 10 days waiting for the rain to stop. And that's all that money was piling up all the time. And eventually they had to leave it and come back and wait for better weather. It would cost anything. There was no rule of thumb cost for a film. We had a guideline from the ministry, but no rule of thumb cost.
What about... how did you keep going? I mean, the Golden Harvest surely didn't provide enough money to keep you going for 2 years, did it, these losses?
No, we made one or two other odd films for the Ministry of Food, you see. Made one for there, I wrote the script for that.
What
wrote
that?
The entire script. It was a food for OK Sauce. You know, asking people... The film was made on the theory that people were leaving food on their plates. The ministry have discovered that people were not cleaning their plates up, you see, the food probably not being too appetizing, and the idea was to encourage the families, and especially the children, to eat their food, to clean the plates, you see. And I wrote that one, and it was in rhyme, and Stanley Holloway spoke the verse.
Can you remember it?
I can't remember much of it. Young Johnny Gadd is a bright young lad with a family serving bravely, his sister Babs in uniform clad, and his dad's in the merchant navy. He's coming home on leave tonight, as soon as I find him, I'll ask him what to give the lad so he leaves no food behind him. I made it to the tune of The Girl I Left Behind Me. I prescribed that as the music, and I wrote the whole thing. Stanley Holloway spoke it, and it was quite a success.
And you'd make more of a profit on the Ministry of Food ones,
wouldn't you? We'd make a profit on that one, yes. Because, you see, the company pay to have it shown in the cinemas. All the commercial films, when they were made, the company had to pay a rental to each cinema for exhibition. You see, 50% of that rental went to the cinema owner, and we kept the other 50. And that's what enabled us to keep going, making a few films of that nature. We couldn't have kept going otherwise. We just managed to keep afloat.
What happened next, then, during the war, if you could take...
Well, we merged in the end of 1942. We merged... You see, I was with the Gaumont Film Company, and we merged with our opposite number in the Odeon cinemas to form a single company to be more economic, you see.
That was 1944.
That was in 1942. We became more economic. And then everything went on until 1944... When we used to do turns on guard, you know, at night in London, with the bombs coming over and the.
What capacity did you take turns on guard?
Pardon?
In what capacity? What were you a member of?
Member of nothing. It was just the building guard. You had someone in case a bomb fell on the building, or somebody was awake, you see, and alert. That's what. It was only just an ordinary guard. No uniform, nothing at all, just alert. In 1944, I'd gone home, and it was a Saturday, 25th of March, and I'd gone home. I was living in a flat alone, but myself, in South Croydon. It was called Ainslie Court, and it was only 6 feet from the wall of the church where I'd been christened as a baby, and my father and mother had been married, and even my father had been christened as a baby. St. Peter's, South Croydon. The wall, my flat was no more than 6 feet from the wall. Well, every night almost the sirens used to go. And there was something come over. They, at that time, the Germans weren't mass bombing; they were hit and run bombers. You see, what they were after was South Croydon Station was only 100 yards away, and it was in a big junction. The lines going into Kent. It was an invasion junction. You see, and they were after it. And so, on this Saturday night, about 11 and nearly midnight, I heard the sirens go, and I wasn't undressed, I was dressed, I had my overcoat on. I went down, my overcoat on, to the entrance to the flats, and I found some people gathered there, and among them there was a lady who lived on the ground floor flat, a teacher she was, school teacher, and she'd got her husband and her young daughter was 9, and she'd come down from Cumberland on holiday just to stay with her mother for a few days, you see. I noticed that the Germans had dropped a marker bomb right over what they thought was the station. There was this red flare hanging low, you know, which was the signal for the German bomber to bomb through it. We adopted the same procedure, I believe, with our own air force. Anyway, there was this shocking marker bomb hanging over, like flare hanging over right over the building, the courtyard of the building. And this little girl, 9, rushed out right into the middle of the courtyard. She looked up, she says, "Oh, isn't it pretty?" She thought she was looking at fireworks, you see. "Isn't it pretty?" And her mother said to me, she said, "Mr. Collins," she says, "do go out and get her in." She says, I'm afraid if anything happened, I should never forgive myself." I said, "All right, I'll go out." And I went out and I got hold of her and I said, "Come on now, come in with me." And she came. And I just got to the entrance of up the steps and standing on the entrance to the flats, block of flats, when the bomb dropped. And I instinctively grabbed her, put my arms around her and pushed her head right into my chest and stopped. But I was half left to the bomb, and it came and hit me right down the side. And I got my overcoat on, and it hit me here, and it smashed the eye to pulp. And there were bits of explosive, bits of glass from the windows of the doorway, all stuck in my face, and it was split down here, and I was bleeding from the artery, you see. And it's a funny thing. When you're hit and wounded, you don't feel it immediately. It's always the shock is always what's called post wounding shock. You get the shock later on, the shock, but you don't feel it a lot immediately you're hit. The pain comes later. And there I stood, and I didn't know. I put my hand up, and I felt all this stuff sticking out here. And I shut one eye, and I couldn't see. And I thought, oh, that's the trouble. But I'm hit there. And the blood was streaming down. Apparently it was streaming down here because the facial artery was cut, you see.
In the cheek, yes.
Streaming down in the cheek. And I stood there, I suppose, for about 20 minutes. And eventually an ambulance came and a doctor. And he took a look at me and he ordered me into the ambulance. And my flat was on the second floor. They told me afterwards if I'd stayed in it, I wouldn't have lived. Because it had swept right through it, you see, the blow stand, the explosion, had gone straight through the window, straight, so I wouldn't have lived. So it was lucky I was down there. And he came on and went to hospital. I arrived at Croydon Hospital sitting up in the ambulance, and as soon as the porter saw me from that hospital, Croydon General, he ordered me down on the floor. He says, for God's sake, don't let him sit up. Put him on the ground, you see. And I had to lay down. I was carried into the hospital on a stretcher, but I'd sat gone all the way as I was sitting up. Anyway, I got into the hospital, and I was laid on the operating table. Straight away, no clothes off or anything, straight on there, straight away. And the first thing, as soon as I laid down, the nurse came and said, "Have you any false teeth?" See? They always ask it because they always take them out for an operation. "Any false teeth?" I said, no false teeth. And then the next thing I felt was a Skinner's mask, which what a Skinner's mask is. It's a mask they put over the nose and mouth, and they squirt the chloroform and ether into it. And the next thing the doctor was saying, "Count with me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and by the time you get to 10, you're out, you see. And I was out, and they operated on that eye and that cheek face. And I have to thank Dr. Davis, the surgeon who carried out the operation, for saving my looks. They pulled the skin right up, stitched it into the corner there tight, as you can see. They stitched it tight in, so that the bone was broken. There was a fracture of the bone in the skull, and a fracture up there of the skull. They pulled it tight in, so although I haven't got a wrinkle at 93, it's not natural. It's the result of my stretched operation, you see. But I have to thank him. Now, isn't it extraordinary? When I was a boy, 6 years of age, I went in there with a broken arm, playing football. And at that long interval, I'd gone in to the same hospital for the only two serious things that happened to me during my life, that caused made an operation.
Did you recover quickly?
No, I didn't recover quickly. I felt very when I woke up about 2 days later in it came to consciousness about 2 days later in Redhill County Hospital, and the pain was intense, really bad. It was maddening, and the office doctor, they were standing watching me come to, you see, the matron and I said to the doctor, begged him for something to kill the pain, he said certainly, and they gave me a painkiller straight away. And from then on I was a month, and then one day, by the way, the bombers were coming over every night, the German bombers passing right over the hospital. And bombers were being shot down not far away by our night fighters, shaking the hut. We were in huts, not a hospital, in the huts, wooden huts, shaking it to pieces. And one one they came up.